You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. And our topic today is, so when did white Christian America lose its mind? And our guest is Xavier Pickett.
Yeah, Xavier is a visiting assistant professor at NYU. And he had a lot of good things to say about white Christian America.
I mean, the word, I don't know if you used the word at all during the interview, but I kept thinking like systemic racism and how deep it is. And he gave a lot of insight about like the Civil War and how the Bible was used and stuff that, you know, you think some of this stuff might be more recent, but the black church has been thinking about this and black theologians have been thinking about this for a long time.
That's what I kept thinking, is how much we have to learn from. We talk about these ancient writers and St. Augustine and these people who've been thinking about it a long time. Well, in this modern conversation of race and the Bible, it's not like these are new things. It's just, do we actually want to take the time and effort to find black authors who have lots of things that they could teach us about this particular moment and how our conversations in the Bible and the church have been shaped by things that happened a few hundred years ago?
And our tone deafness to all that, that's part of, you know, white privilege and that systemic racism, even if we don't mean it, it's the fact that it's not on our radar screen is the problem all to itself.
Well, Xavier talks about willful ignorance. And I think there's something, there's really something important to that. I think, was it Upton Sinclair said something about like, it's really hard to understand something when so much rides on you not understanding it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it's easy to be ignorant of things when it's helpful for you not to understand it. Not
doesn't
to search
upset
it out.
The world and how you look right at yourself and the universe you live in. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, let's have this conversation with Xavier Pickett.
Scripture will seem to suggest that the Bible is a pro-slavery document. You actually have to work extraordinarily hard to read the Bible otherwise, and not just read the Bible, to actually understand how would people even at that time have a different view. It's not until very recent history that we have any human rights and equality. And so we can think about women as property. It's really hard to get a view of the Bible that seems to suggest that the Bible is an abolitionist text.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. And today we have Xavier Pickett. So welcome, Xavier. Thank you so much for being on with us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely.
So we want to start, as we often do, by basically we want to know what turns ordinary, normal folks like you into nerds. So just walk us through a little bit of your religious history, your spiritual background, and its intersection with the Bible that kind of leads us to where we are now.
Thank you for that question. It's a really good question. Question I get, you know, quite often, and it's very interesting to be able to talk about that publicly, and so I'm almost being on a record. So one way I can kind of begin is I grew up in a religious Christian background in particular that took the Bible really serious, so much so that we kind of described ourselves as something like KJV only. You know, King James Version of the Bible, that was kind of the authorized Bible. That not only the authorized, that was the only text and translation that was considered the Word of God. And so other translations like the NIV or RSV, those translations were, you know, looked upon with suspicion. Not just with suspicion, they were oftentimes considered not quite the Word of God. They were, wouldn't go so far as to say counterfeits, but some would at that time. And so that was kind of part of my religious background growing up as a kid. But eventually, you know, as I continued to study the scriptures, and one of the kind of hallmark sort of passages for me growing up is study to show thyself approved. So I really took that quite seriously, and I was really Socratic to the core from a very early age. I was that kid in the church who asked a question to the pastor and to other leaders about, well, if Jesus died on Friday and, let's just say, got up on Sunday, what happened to the other day? Because if it's 3 days, you know, it seems to be a day missing. So, and I was quickly, you know, ran out of the conversation and in some cases ran out of the building. So I was always asking questions about the Bible and about Christianity broadly. And so eventually led me to do a number of things along the way, one of which planted a church prior to going to seminary right after undergrad, from leading Bible studies on college campuses, you know, doing various sorts of trips, mission trips. Then eventually I decided to go to seminary to get some former training, because the training that I had been doing on my own I can get that training a lot quicker in a concentrated, structured setting. And largely because of biblical languages, I was trying to teach myself Greek, and I wasn't picking it up fast enough. So that was one of the motivating factors to kind of go to seminary, because I wanted to be able to read the Bible in its original languages, and not just to be subject to various translations, English translations. So I went to seminary at Westminster Theological in Philadelphia, and there I kind of began to sink my teeth into, well, let me just say something that might be helpful too. I get this question a bit, like why I chose Westminster, particularly being a black person in the U.S. And it's like, well, what, out of all the places you could have gone, why Westminster? Well, one of the reasons why I chose Westminster was at that time and where I was theologically is that I wanted to be at a seminary that had something like a kind of coherent theological vision. Because what I realized when I was trying to decide about where I wanted to go, that a number of the people at other seminaries, divinity schools, some of the graduates, that is, and even current students I had talked to, there was a lot of competing views that I got from students at the same seminary and divinity school. And so, but when I talked to people who had graduated from Westminster, a number of people, they had a similar and shared sort of like way of thinking about the Bible. And the reason why that was important for me, because I realized that there was multiple interpretations of the Bible. And so that we have one particular passage could generate several interpretations. And so that alerted me to the fact that, well, there are some things that we need to talk about that we don't often talk about. That is our presuppositions. And so, like, what are the things that actually inform our interpretation that actually leads to these multiple interpretations? And so Westminster at the time, through, you know, people like Cornelius Van Til, and kind of really taking seriously presuppositions and that end up becoming a particular sort of way of thinking about Christian apologetics, presuppositional apologetics, that was something that I was attracted to, because I realized that we have to talk about our presuppositions. And because our presuppositions have much to do with how we read and interpret the scriptures. And so I wanted to be an institution that, as they said at that time, you know, very much epistemologically subconscious. And so I was really compelled by that sort of way of approaching the Bible and a way of thinking about Christian theology broadly. If the institution like Westminster had a shared, the faculty and the school broadly had, you know, similar and shared sort of like theological presuppositions, then the types of curriculum and types of classes and discussions would be a much more coherent, as opposed to a kind of hodgepodge, smorgasbord that one might find at other seminaries and divinity schools and theological institutions. While the smorgasbord, I'm not necessarily making a judgment about it, it's just where I was at that time. I would prefer and desire something much more sort of cohesive.
Yeah, so what happened though, right? Because you didn't stay there, right? I mean, theologically, you grew or moved or whatever since that time?
That's right. And so part of that shift, you know, I was really interested in the Reformed theological tradition. And part of what accounted for that shift is that I was really trying to wrestle with, at a broad level, what does it mean to be black and Christian? And more specifically, what does it mean to be black and Reformed? And so, and that really led me to begin reading and reaching outside of the Reformed tradition to make sense of that. And so one of the ways in which I did that was really to end up developing and creating and founding a nonprofit. So because I realized that there was other black Christians out there who took themselves to be Reformed, who didn't know each other. And so, and who were also wrestling with these same sorts of questions. What does it mean to be black and Reformed? So I kind of set myself really on a mission to really think about that conjunction and to, in some ways, to make that conjunction, in some ways, to get rid of that conjunction, and to really to suggest, well, what does it mean to think about black Reform theology? And that allowed me to see that Reform tradition has been inhabited by black people in particular sorts of ways, some of which is very inhabited position, that theological sort of tradition and those positions very critically. So I began to really trying to merge in my own mind, but also thinking about the ways in which other people have really tried to think the Reform tradition as well as the black theological traditions of various sorts together. And that kind of allowed me to reposition myself in relationship to Reform theology in more critical ways, but also in new ways. And that sort of gave birth to a new sort of institution, a nonprofit that I created, Reform Blacks of America, but also kind of gave birth to an emerging, you know, intellectual vision that I had at that time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking about a kind of uncharted territory, at least for a lot of us, with this Black Reformed. And how do you navigate these things? And so who was guiding you in that? Were there certain intellectuals or certain authors or certain people that you found could be a guide for you in that conversation?
Yeah, and so I was beginning to, particularly while at Westminster, but also a little bit before, were already in conversation with a number of Black ministers and academics who had situated themselves within particular like Presbyterian sort of denominations, you know, one of which is like Carl Ellis and those type of folks. And what I began to realize is that there were other people who were wrestling with these issues as well before me. But what I realized is, you know, in addition to that, more work, particularly theologically, needed to be done to really think about the complexities of the Reformed tradition and the ways in which kind of that tradition and the way of reading the Bible what had really obfuscated the sort of Black theological sort of like ways of interpreting the Bible and Black theological traditions, you know, the Black people within these sorts of denominations who were making significant sort of claims and demands on these sorts of Reformed denominations, and how might taking those things seriously actually give us a different understanding of the tradition and give us a different understanding of reading the Bible.
What are some examples of that, Xavier? You mentioned this obfuscation and different interpretations and people challenging these denominational standards or traditions. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a number of Black, even Presbyterian ministers, for instance, you know, even before the Civil War, you know, who situated themselves within Presbyterianism. You know, people like J.W. C. Pennington, Theodore Wright, you know, one of who in many ways considered, you know, one of the first sort of Black graduates of Princeton Theological Seminary. You know, all of this is still antebellum. And then there's many people who came after that, you know, Henry Holland Garnett, who most notably known for the declaration and the profound sort of theological claim that God is a Negro. And in many ways, these questions and different ways of reading the Bible was precipitated around the Civil War, you know, and around slavery. And the debates that sort of ensued by Christian ministers across the country, in the colonies particularly at the time, around whether or not the Bible justifies slavery. And the stances that were taken by many, you know, white Christian denominations were in many ways pro-slavery. And so the ways in which many Black ministers and laity, I mean Christians, will in some ways contest those sorts of readings of the Bible as being those type of readings that would suggest that slavery is, let's just say, biblical, morally permissible, and those sorts of things. And so there's a tradition that wants to read against that, a type of abolitionism. Abolitionist sort of like biblical sort of reading that is in some ways is represented through an African-American sort of biblical interpretive traditions. So those are some examples of individuals and ways of thinking that kind of trouble how the Bible has typically been understood. And for me, that was really instructive because, you know, one could think about even Mark Knowles, that the Civil War is a theological crisis. While we can raise some questions about some of the other things in that text, one thing is really important to understand he lives up is that the country went to war over the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, and the way in which the Bible actually was reinforcing a type of claim about states' rights and these sorts of things. And so, and one could say, well, the South, to put it very crudely here, that the South in some ways were more biblical than the North, in that the South, many Southern Christian ministers and theologians at the time were arguing that the Bible does endorse slavery. And the North, many of them wanted to read the Bible in such a way to suggest otherwise.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I mean, my take on that, for what it's worth, and correct me, but in the South, they had more of a, what we might call a biblicistic reading of these texts, like here they are and that's it. And the North might have had what some call more of a trajectory reading. Like, yeah, we know what these passages say, but the gospel as a whole is going in a different kind of direction. Is
that? No, exactly.
Okay, so we have, there really is sort of a battle, not just for the Bible, but for how to read it.
Exactly.
And that's all started before the Civil War.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's news, I think, to a lot of people, that it's not a recent thing since, you know, maybe the early 20th century, but this has been going on for a while in our country.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, part of the worry that many in the South had, many of the Christian, you know, leaders, is that they saw that the North was reading as we can say, extra biblical sort of principles and norms into the Bible, that certain views about like human equality, for instance, you know, that they were taking these ideas that are found outside the Bible as a way to read the Bible. And so in this sense, I mean, it raises a whole host of questions around quote unquote modern sorts of readings, some of the worries about, you know, how to read the Bible from our particular vantage point versus the vantage point of the original writers and these sorts of things, all the things that you guys are fully aware. I'm not a Hebrew Bible scholar or New Testament scholar or late antiquity, so I must at least register that for our time together in conversation.
Yeah, I don't think that's even necessary to register because it's sort of obvious. That's my opinion anyway.
But it's also, I think, I mean, there's something that seems like there should be named that. There's something to that. It's kind of what I'm hearing you say, Xavier, is yeah, if you adopt a certain way of reading the Bible, then it's almost the logical conclusion. If you start with these certain presuppositions about what the Bible is and how to read it, a logical conclusion would be to endorse slavery as a plain, quote unquote, plain reading of Scripture. And for me, that seems to be troubling, where that can be the conclusion you come to if you adopt a certain, in some ways, people who have a certain hermeneutic or interpretive lens seem to have to do a lot more gymnastics not to come to those conclusions. Would that be fair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because I can state this in more provocative terms, that the Bible can easily be read, and really, particularly, and this is the language that you just used, is really important here, to plain read the Scripture, what seems to suggest that the Bible is a pro-slavery document, that you actually have to work extraordinarily hard to read the Bible otherwise. And not just read the Bible, to actually understand just historically, well, how would people even at that time have a different view? I mean, it's not until like into very recent history that we have anything like human rights and human equality in the way in which we think about those things currently on the 20th and 21st century. And so if we can think about women, all these sorts of things. I mean, it's property. It's really hard to get a view of the Bible that seems to suggest that the Bible is an abolitionist text. So yeah, and if that's true, then how do we actually, you know, read the Bible? How is it the case that now we have a pretty standard and mainstream view of the Bible that suggests like, well, of course, slavery is wrong, morally wrong, and of course the Bible isn't for slavery. How is that now a mainstream acceptable view? In other words, to come to that particular view, one has to actually admit to be aware of the types of assumptions and presuppositions that one actually possess as modern readers, that we have as we're using these particular sets of presuppositions about like what does it mean to be human and equality and so forth, and we're reading that into this particular text.
So we're bringing things from outside of the Bible to sort of solve this moral problem?
Absolutely. I mean, the question around slavery in the Bible and various forms of slavery within the Bible raises not just historical and like questions around translation, but it raises a moral question. I mean, I think the slavery question really presents a moral crisis, actually. And it's actually these sorts of like concerns that lead many African-Americans particularly away from the Bible, or at least away from a typical sort of like mainstream sort of white in certain circles, like evangelical sort of interpretation of the Bible that really obscures the kind of the moral stakes of this text. And so, and this kind of what end up emerging when slaves, you know, enslaved people sort of get a hold of the Bible. And this is what the worries about whether or not we want, particularly white slave owners, whether or not they wanted to evangelize slaves, whether or not they wanted to teach slaves the Bible, because if many of them knew if they taught slaves the Bible, it could backfire. And so while on the one hand, teaching them the Bible could make them more docile, more obedient, you know, because we have passages like slaves obey your masters. But on the other hand, you know, there's other passages that seem to suggest like, well, maybe we are kind of like all God's children. Maybe we all sort of priesthood of all believers, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there is no slave or free, you know, in Paul.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned before Mark Knoll and his book. Well, the name of his book again is what is it?
The Civil War as a Theological Crisis.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember one of our seminary professors said that like the crisis of the 19th century for quote the authority of the Bible, it wasn't German higher criticism, it wasn't archaeology, it wasn't Darwin, it was slavery in America, because you can't even go to the Bible to find a clear answer on the pressing moral problem of the time. And that has led people, I think what you're describing is it's led people to say, listen, maybe the Bible is not set up to answer this question for us. Maybe we have to think about this. And what I'm wondering is, like what happened to lead people to a more, what I called before, a trajectory view of interpreting the Bible? What might have caused people to say, listen, we can't just read Bible verses here. We have to do something else.
Yeah, that would be a really fascinating sort of study. I think, and I want to kind of think about this out loud a bit, if I can.
That's how I write. Yeah, go right ahead. I just sort of riff. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I mean, it's a way to make the Bible more respectable, right? And so, that, in other words, you have abolitionist sort of movements and ideals that are taking hold and root within the U.S. and, of course, across the pond in the U.K. So, and I think, you know, many people in the 19th century and forward begin to buy into the view that, yeah, I guess we are kind of all the same human beings. But yet, the Bible not only describes a world in which human beings are treated unequally, but it actually seems to justify the operations and processes and structures to maintain those hierarchies. So what do we do? And so we have to come up, we have to read the Bible in such a way to get that sort of trajectory that you were just describing, to read the Bible as a way to sort of flatten out those hierarchies between human beings. And so, but the reality is, at a moment in which those hierarchies seem to be flattened, there are actually other hierarchies that end up emerging in that process. And by that, I mean, at a moment in which we're all becoming all God's children, we also end up becoming white, right? And so all God's children actually end up being a sort of kind of, so in other words, the project of becoming all God's children is actually a deracializing project. But that deracializing project is a way in which they continue to mask and evade the ways in which whiteness actually is functioning as a type of universal sort of like standard that goes unarticulated, that goes unnamed. And so that this particular way of reading the Bible, that this particular way of being God's children, this particular way of being Christian actually begins to be the standard, right? And so this is how, to put it another way to illustrate this, I mean, how Jesus actually ended up becoming white in the process.
So what I hear you saying is, it's okay, we can have a new trajectory and everyone can be God's children and we can read these things in as long as it can be baptized into the dominant narrative of whiteness. And that's the way that we can have this unifying structure. If it's all about unity, that's great. But then when you look behind the curtain, unity is actually just an excuse to continue to privilege the whiteness and not allow for this other diversity to emerge.
Absolutely. And that has really gone unarticulated. And so I don't want to get too far off here, but in my class earlier today on American religion that I teach here at NYU, you know, we were talking about the Scopes trial earlier this week, revisiting it from a different standpoint, because we were talking about what some has described as kind of the end of white Christian America. And so one of the things I raise is that, like, well, why all of a sudden we were considering white Christian America to be dead at this moment? How is it that that narrative even exists? And I said, you know, at around the time where, you know, the kind of modernist fundamentalist controversy around the Scopes trial, evolution, and these sorts of things, you know, this was like a big deal. A lot of sort of like ink was spilt. Obviously, we know William James Bryant died right after the Scopes trial, interestingly enough. So there's a lot of contestation around these sorts of theological issues. But around the time in which the Scopes trial was such a big deal, this is also around the height of lynching. And we know that there's, you know, Christian churches and ministers and, you know, were involved in lynching. After a Sunday morning worship, they'll go out and go lynch black people. But why was that not a controversy? Why was that didn't reach kind of a crisis status in America? Why wasn't white Christian America dead at that point? Because it has read the Bible in such a way that these particular set of like moral issues are actually not even theological issues. And so there's something about the way in which white people have read the Bible in this country that refuses to interrogate the types of their own sort of like moral lives, and in particular ways in which their moral lives impact the lives of other people, particularly people of color broadly, but also black people. I mean, because if that interrogation was to occur, one might see that the moral lives that are presented as models of good Christian living might actually be immoral. It might be immoral. And so in this way, it raises a fundamental question about, well, are these people really Christian? And this is what the black sort of like theological tradition of various sorts here in the U.S. and various sort of African-American biblical interpretations really raising that. How is it that these people could still claim to be Christian and treat their sisters and brothers and other people identify as in various other ways immorally?
Well, okay, so tie this in, because I think I'm getting it, but you mentioned before a very interesting idea that the Scopes Monkey Trial meant like the beginning of the end of white Christian America. And I think I'm tying those things together that you're saying now, but could you be more explicit? Because that's a really important idea. I think I get it, but I don't want to be wrong.
Yeah, so part of I was just suggesting to my students earlier this week, that moment can be seen as like a death of white Christian America. All right. And so there's other moments. We can go, as we were talking about, you know, the Civil War and slavery, we can argue that to what degree did white Christian America ever really lived? Like, to what degree did it ever become a fully sort of like living organism, right? Such that it can be said to be really alive.
Are you saying it was white Christian America was exposed for the problem that it is during this time?
Yeah. I mean, that's one way to kind of, we want to like go back and sort of and read the history in a larger sort of context in the early 20th century. We can read like, well, while they're arguing about these particular like minute theological issues, while at the very same time engaging and other sort of immoral sort of practices in terms of their institutions, churches, seminary, divinity schools, like, and also at the theological level, right? I mean, where segregation, there was theological justification for segregation, theological justification for lynching, for slavery. And so what I'm saying is that we might be tempted to believe in our current moment, given the sort of the recent presidential elections, really be like, oh my God, what is happening in our country? That these evangelicals and other Christians have just kind of lost their mind. Well, from the standpoint of African Americans and a particular sort of like African American sort of religious tradition and prophetic and political tradition, that these people have lost their mind a long time ago. And so like this country was born out of people who have lost their mind, and one might want to raise the question, well, not they ever had it to begin with.
Right. So I hear that rather than sort of being outraged or surprised by the theological discourse or how we talk about God and how God endorses certain moral behaviors or practices or immoral practices and behaviors, we could actually look back and see that there's these certain moments where this has been exposed again and again. And the Scopes trial is one of those moments where we're forced to see or to try and reconcile this interesting phenomena where the whole world's aflame, or at least in America, over evolution, and yet there's too much quiet about lynchings. Like, so when you put these side by side, it sort of exposes this gross injustice and how the dominant people in America have constantly propped up their lives, right, through these narratives of how to read the Bible and never interrogating it. It's never to sort of question, where are we more like the Pharisees? Where are we more like the oppressors? Where are we more like the Egyptians? But we can see throughout American history, it's been more of how we justify and prop up the status quo.
Yeah, and this is precisely what led James Cone, you know, the father of academic black theology, to write the book The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Because to really to talk about the cross in America for Cone, you know, one has to talk about lynching, because the closest example that we have of the cross is lynching. So for him, that we can't understand the cross without understanding lynching, and you can't really understand lynching in America without understanding the cross. It was a form of execution, both the cross and lynching, for different sorts of reasons, you know, but in some ways those reasons aren't all that dissimilar. Both Jesus and black people were seen as a threat to the state and also to particular communities, particularly those communities that are in control. And in this case, in the U.S., is a threat to white power, particularly in the early 20th century, you know, come out of this era of the so-called Reconstruction, where the country wants to kind of rebuild itself. And while this rebuilding effort is being made, there's deep worries about whether or not black people, if they really were to experience and participate in political civic life in the U.S., then that means it could threaten various sorts of establishments. And so there was an attempt to curtail and to contain that progress, particularly in the most well-known institutional wise is the KKK. And that's just sort of like one sort of easy sort of example as this sort of like renegade vigilante sort of group. You know, that engaged in like all kinds of like terrorist acts, you know, because it was meant lynching was meant to terrorize black people.
Yeah, well, let me ask something, Xavier. I think this may sound like an obvious question to answer, but I'm assuming you're of the opinion that racism in the American church has not been taken as seriously as it should have been over the past, say, 100 years. It's this problem that keeps popping up, and we don't really talk about it very much, but it sort of informs so much of maybe what's wrong with white America, white Christian America. Is that fair? I mean, would you want to put that another way? But that's just sort of what I'm seeing more and more the older I get.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Because part of what it means to grapple with racism, if what we mean by racism is something more than just interpersonal sort of like prejudice, if racism is more than that, if racism signals something like the way in which I like to talk about, beyond just kind of intent and motivation of a singular individual, if it's more than just that and is actually about a larger set of like practices, you know, cultural sort of practices, really institutional sort of practices of like racial inequality, and a really an investment and commitment to whiteness, right? And so we can see this from various sorts of ways, from various, like, you know, European sort of immigrants, you know, coming to the U.S. at various moments in the, you know, 19th and 20th century, is that, you know, from Irish and Dutch, I mean, eventually became white. And so that there is actually a value to become white. We see this legally, various legal cases that we can cite. Questions around one drop rules are interesting ways in which. So there's always been an obsession around purity, to put it in more macro terms. And so Christian churches particularly have always been trying to police those boundaries. Police those boundaries, you know, theologically, but also police those boundaries in terms of their rituals, in terms of like their at institutional level, in terms of who they admit into their congregations, who can be ordained, under what circumstance, if any. I was talking today in class, we were talking about religion and politics, and particularly like around the 2007 and 2008, around the presidential election of 08, around Mitt Romney. And that moment, you know, in Meet the Press, where Tim Russert asked Mitt Romney about the Mormon church and how is it that the Mormon church, you know, allowed black people to be ordained in 1978, as late as 1978. But those sorts of practices and policies of anti-blackness have always marked white Christian churches from the very beginning. And so there's a desire over the last 20, 30 years, you know, it had a moment of kind of racial reconciliation in many, you know, white Christian churches at various moments. But part of what that assumes and what it doesn't recognize is that black people didn't decide to leave white churches because they didn't like white people, right? Or they just didn't decide to leave white churches in general. That they were actually kicked out from the very beginning, right? And so when people ask, well, why, they're like, why aren't black people and white people and so forth and so on and various groups of people like worshiping under the same roof? Well, it's not because of like black people said, well, we're out of here, we're going to go do our own thing, you know, because we've been enslaved. Well, no, it's like, well, white people said, well, we actually don't want you here. So it's like, okay, well, black people had to create their own sorts of institutions, even though those institutions already sort of had been created in informal and more kind of covert ways, because enslaved folks who were Christian, you know, they were already engaged in various sorts of like religious practices and their own sort of building of it is what a number of black religious scholars have called, you know, the invisible institution. So it's an invisible institution that, namely, sort of like the emergence of kind of this black church that, of course, is not monolithic, that have always existed. And this is partly what created some of the shock and awe of the 2008 election around Jeremiah Wright and Obama. So while Obama had to kind of distance himself from his own church, his own black church, because most of white America was like, they were shocked by Jeremiah Wright's sermon, that soundbite, when Jeremiah Wright said, God damn America. And they was like, well, is that what black churches are talking about? Of course, they took it out of context. What was taken out of context is a larger sort of tradition of black Christians who have been very critical of the U.S. and also of white Christian America along some of these sorts of lines. I mean, we can think about even Westminster and his own practices of like segregation, you know, that we all have some connection to that institution. Like a number of these institutions weren't letting black people into their schools, for instance, but yet they claim to be Christian.
So what's your tenor? What are you hopeful about this? What's the trajectory of the conversations that you've been having and the things that you've been seeing in? Because I can't help but think that, you know, maybe it's just because I've been in more different circles, but this idea of black theology and giving it more of a place and allowing it to start properly critiquing white theology and even having such a thing as black theology, and it's not subsumed under this wider umbrella, has impacted sort of feminist readings, has impacted how we read the Bible in relation to LGBTQ communities. And overall, I feel like there's more discussions of how the Bible has been used to oppress and more conversations about how to have different readings of the Bible that actually liberate and open up the conversation. Is this a trend? Is this a trajectory? Are you hopeful?
Hopeful that more people will take seriously black theology and...
Yeah. Are we heading in a way that we're starting to unwind some of these several hundred years of intertwining the Bible and oppression?
I don't know, to be honest. At the moment, I'm not very hopeful because anti-blackness and white supremacy these are particular sort of viewpoints and practices that are something like intractable. It's hard to give up these particular like ways of thinking and ways of organizing ourselves, both in, at more macro level, but also more micro levels. I mean, because to give up the powers and privileges of whiteness is something like unimaginable, right? It's hard to imagine a world like exactly like what that would look like for many people.
Yeah, when you're not in control.
Exactly.
It's almost like you have to die to yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, right. This is precisely like some of the language that's found within black theology and a lot of like African-American letters broadly, particularly like, you know, Baldwin, is that it is a death, and that requires a rebirthing, a resurrection, right? But that resurrection, I mean, this is partly what Cohn means, that when he says that white people have to become black, right? And becoming black isn't simply about phenotype. It's about a new sort of like moral center and practice, right? A new way of relating to ourselves in non-dominating ways, in ways that are not oppressive. And so... But to become black actually means divesting oneself of whiteness. And so whether or not, I mean, many was hopeful that that was on its way in 2008 when many believed that we were entering into this post-racial moment with Obama, you know, as understood to be this kind of first African-American president. And, you know, shortly thereafter, we found out that the honeymoon, that this sort of illusion of post-racial America was precisely that. It was an illusion, right? Because what we failed to really take seriously, particularly like for people who are interested in the religion and studying it, and particularly Christianity, that we failed to understand and recognize that who was actually on the VP ticket on the other side, on the Republican, who was John McCain running mate? It was Sarah Palin, right? And Sarah Palin was clearly mobilizing a type of like Christianity that morphed into the Tea Party, that eventually morphed into kind of birtherism. And we saw who became the figurehead of the birther movement. And that led to our current president.
So I hear you saying it takes a divestiture of whiteness and white becoming black. Can you tie into, like, what are some ways, I just can think of people listening to say, I want to better understand what that means, especially maybe since we are the Bible for normal people. What are ways that intersects with how we read the Bible moving forward? So maybe some practical things that people who are listening can do to better move this thing forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think one practical thing to do is read black biblical scholars. Pick up Cain Hopfelder's Stony the Road We Trod, you know, African-American Biblical Interpretation. That sort of volume has a number of essays that'll be very instructive, written by a number of, you know, black biblical scholars and scholars who are thinking about the Bible from these particular lenses. That's one thing. You know, I know that's probably not the most satisfying answer, you know, to tell people to go read, but I think it's really unavoidable. So, I mean, because partly what creates these sorts of challenges is just a lot of like misinformation, you know, not just misinformation, but actually a desire to want to be uninformed. That is to say, a desire to want to be ignorant. You know, we could think of, and this is precisely what someone like Baldwin is really trying to fight against. It's not just that white people don't know. It's actually also trying to fight against the desire to remain ignorant. In other words, a type of willful ignorance. So in this way, like one is actually trying to cultivate desires and enlarge those desires to know more, not just for the sake of knowing, but also for the sake of actually to reorder one's self in the world morally, and that we can act more ethically regarding how we relate to each other interpersonally, but also institutionally, right? So that we all possess various degrees of power and authority in our own sort of like domain of life. So, and the question is how we use that authority, you know, in our families, you know, in the workplace, in our affiliations and ties, in various civic groups. So we all have like some measure of authority and power. So we're not helpless. So the question is, do we use the type of authority and power that we have to sustain and to fight against various forms of injustice, not just racial injustice, but, you know, all kinds of injustice and all kinds of like practices of domination. So it's really being committed to that, you know, whether in a particular church, synagogue, mosque, temple, and finding, we don't have to look very hard to live into these particular sets of ideals. While diversity talk is all the rage in particular settings, you know, whether in the corporate setting and higher ed, you know, churches in particular sorts of ways with kind of multicultural churches and multiculturalism. But all those things just reinforce, you know, in many ways, the status quo. We just have, you know, more people of color in higher places while all of the processes and policies remain the same. So we just continue to, and in other words, to reinforce the status quo is to really to maintain a commitment, investment in white power structures and dominations, you know, or at least the conditions for domination to be able to dominate, you know, other people who don't actually, or who fall outside of, or who might be, let's just say, I put it this way, for those people who might be more critical of current set of arrangements, whatever they might be, was in a workplace or in a political arena. And so, because those people who are a bit more critical tend to be, you know, continuing to push on the side. But, you know, we can, various people who are in power, they can, we can do all kinds of things to make sure that that the people who might actually be our critics, and in some ways people might view them as our enemies, that those people actually should be the people who we should be talking to the most. So, yeah, I mean, it seems like trying to create a world where that actually is desirable as an end in itself, not just desirable because, like, if we have, you know, this kind of diverse array of people, we can be more profitable as a as an institution, as a business, or we can look like we, or this business or organization can look more respectable. It can look like something like a more sort of global sort of vision. But those sorts of things just are committed to and interested in just the appearances, the semblances of equity, while actually trafficking in all kinds of inequalities, you know. And so we just have to be, I was to say this last part, we just have to give up the showmanship. We got to give up sort of like just being obsessed with appearances, wanting to appear like we are better than what we are when we're not, and actually get on with the business, the hard sort of task of doing the divestment, doing the work that that are going to make our organizations uncomfortable, and running the risk that our organizations and our practices and policies, if they become much more sort of like equitable and just, run the risk that maybe our organization might not exist anymore.
Right.
That's okay. Like, we actually might need less organizations, less institutions,
right,
you know, less sort of whatever, in order to have a better, you know, society.
Yeah, true deep transformation and not just appearances. You know, this is obviously a huge topic that on one level people might think it's talked about all the time, but it isn't talked about enough. And we're speaking of time, we're coming to the end of our time here. And maybe if you can just let people know if you're working on anything at this point, or if they want to connect with you, like online or social media or anything like that, where they can find you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as visible on social media. I'm out there, but I'm not as out there as I'm a lot of people. But I can be found on Facebook if people type me in, type my name in, and I can be found that way. I'm not on Twitter. Maybe I'll get on there, but there's questions around sort of surveillance, you know, and technologies, you know, and these corporations that, that warrants discussion too, particularly in our religious communities, because there's much discussion need to be talked about that as well, the ways in which some of these companies are targeting various religious groups and religious individuals.
Any projects?
Yeah, so the projects, you know, working on two projects that are cooking, you know, slowly. So some of which is already, some things have already been that are done, but won't be released for a while. One is on Black Rage. So I'm working on a theory of Black Rage to get beyond that sort of like anecdotal, sort of like an ad hoc analysis and thinking about the thinking that exists around the concept of Black Rage. So that's one, as well as I'm thinking about the category of Black religion and sort of an academic study of Black religion and how might we need to rethink that based upon African American literature, some of the stuff around secularism, you know, stuff around sort of AFAT. So those are kind of two projects. One thing I could point people to if they want to get a sense of where I am, and of course, that some of what went into me, like James Cone, you can Google my recent article that was published in Black Perspectives. Is the publishing arm of the African American Intellectual Historical Society. The article is very brief, sort of like piece on the late Cone, because he passed earlier this year in April. The title of that piece is Honoring the Sacred Fire of James Cone. If people want another way into this and to think about the significance of James Cone and what I would argue, and I think I might have said this in the piece, is the greatest theologian that this country has ever produced. And so I'm willing to stand by that. And for those people who are interested in theology and what this country has produced in terms of theologians and theological knowledge, then to not read James Cone is to do yourself not just an intellectual disservice, but a moral disservice. That, in other words, I think one's moral vision and moral theological vision would be significantly diminished without really engaging very carefully and seriously his work. So that piece is there for those who are interested.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Xavier, for coming on. And yeah, we really appreciate it.
Thank you all so much. It was good to be able to have a conversation with you guys again. It's been far too long.
Same here, buddy.
Alrighty.
All right. See ya.
All right, everyone, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening and supporting our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We want to give a big shout out to our producers group who support us over on Patreon. They are the reason we are able to keep bringing podcasts and other content to you. So big thanks to Amanda Baggett, Caleb Sharp, David Portillo, Hannah Paxton, Joe Johnson, Kristen Backman, Matt Stein, Peter Hack, Sam and Nicole Galambos, and Vicky Hansen. If you would like to help support the podcast, head over to patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople, where for as little as $3 a month, you can receive bonus material, be part of an online community, get course discounts, and much more. We couldn't do what we do without your support.
Our show is produced by Stephanie Spate. Audio engineer was Dave Gerhardt. Creative director, Tessa Stoltz. Community champion, Ashley Ward. And web developer, Nick Striegel. For Pete, Jared, and the entire Bible for Normal People team, thanks for listening.